All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yep, once again, I am Michael Slate. There you go. And we'll see who I am next week, okay? We have a really, really packed show today and a really important show. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Jen Marlowe, award-winning author, documentary filmmaker, and playwright, and human rights activist who's been reporting on the struggle to stop the Bayou Bridge pipeline in Louisiana. Now, this is the last segment of the Dakota Access Pipeline with all its dangers to nearby residents and to the life on the planet. So that's going to be, make sure you stay tuned for that. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show Sansara Taylor, a writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism. And Sansara is joining us to talk about the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the danger Kavanaugh represents, and the determined and righteous protest inside and outside the hearing room, and all of this stuff, and including, what the hell do we do now? Sansara, welcome to the show.
Michael, it's great to be with you.
Yeah, well, I have like 27 questions for you, okay?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
You narrowed it down, huh?
Yeah. Okay. I was at it all night, okay? Anyway, let's jump into this first. You know, this Kavanaugh, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings. I wanted to get your overall picture of what's happening right now, not just with Kavanaugh, although that's the heart of a lot of it, but in terms of what's happening immediately, but just sort of the scene that we find ourselves in now, what's being enforced here, what's developing, and then in relation to that, the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings.
Yeah, well, look, I want to start with Kavanaugh in a certain sense and put him in a context, but we are living through the last few days really the judicial nomination hearings of the most monumental shift to the highest court in the land that we've seen in decades and decades. And it is very difficult to overstate the danger, the qualitative danger, that a 5-4 pro-fascist Supreme Court will mean for millions and millions of real people's lives in a very sweeping and dramatic way, and for generations to come. I mean, Kavanaugh, there's quite a bit of exposure about him that's come out, but there's also a tremendous amount of obfuscation and normalization and all of this. But this is a man who is a strict originalist, a textualist, somebody whose legal theory really does hold that the courts need to interpret, in his view, the laws and the Constitution as it was originally written, its actual text, and as it was, either if a right is not explicitly in the original text of the Constitution in an amendment that has been passed, or in, quote, the traditions and conscience of our people, that it doesn't exist as an actual right. And if you look at the Constitution, you look at the amendments, you look at the history of this country, the traditions and the conscience of America, and it's been shot through from the beginning to today with white supremacy, with patriarchy. It's reflected and it's defended and enforced the property relations of a capitalist society, the exploitation embedded in that. And really, there have been some changes, there have been some expansions of the rights that are granted to the people, but that has always come through tremendous struggle, not because they were enumerated in the original Constitution. And so you have somebody who is of a legal view and part of a many-year building backlash against a lot of the concessions that were won through the civil rights movement, through the civil liberties that have been won, the rights of women to abortion and birth control that have been won, which are very tenuous, very hard-fought, but also very undermined already. And here you have somebody coming and being appointed to the court at a time and really as a centerpiece of the imposition of a fascist America, because this is a judge who is nominated by and sits in a certain place in the consolidation of fascism by the Trump-Pence regime. And I guess just to make my opening remarks very lengthy, I have to add, even before, you know, this has really bothered me. I give great love and support and backing to those who have courageously stood up and disrupted this hearing. There's been over 100 people did so on the first day. They were arrested and dragged out. More than 55 people did the second day. More have continued each day. But at the same time, I have to say over and over again, there's some people who are speaking up about abortion rights. There's some people speaking up about disability rights, and they're talking about the issues affecting people. But there's also people standing up and saying, save our court, save our court. And I just want to say, this is not our court. It wasn't our court before. The Supreme Court, even before Kavanaugh, is the Supreme Court that upheld the Muslim ban. It's the Supreme Court that just a month ago struck down a California law that would have required anti-abortion fake so-called clinics to disclose to the teenagers and women coming into their doors who are desperate, for whom pregnancy is experienced as a crisis, that would have forced these anti-abortion facilities to come clean and say we're not in a medical facility. And the Supreme Court says no, they don't have to say that. This is already what the court has done. So this is a court that reflects the ruling interests of a society, a capitalist imperialist society that has got white supremacy and patriarchy and exploitation and international plunder woven into its foundation, and now it's making a shift to become a fully pro-fascist court. It's an incredible danger facing the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's continue along that line, because that's actually one of the things I wanted to get into in terms of this. Look, to me, it seems this is a part of Trump consolidating, really, a fascist Supreme Court, and that makes a difference for a lot of people in terms of what they're actually looking at. I wanted to ask you to speak to that. What actually will the difference be? There'll be dire consequences. I mean, this is something that can actually have a major impact on, you know, if you've been sitting there and you've been thinking, okay, well, Trump's doing this, he's doing that, he's doing this, and this, but there's safeguards against this, or there's he couldn't do that. And actually, this, if and when it seems that Kavanaugh gets brought into the fold there, it's actually going to make a huge difference in terms of what the Nazis are actually able to do and accomplish in society at large.
Yeah, I think there's a whole host of things. There's Kavanaugh has hostility towards, he calls it the so-called wall of separation between church and state. He is somebody he's actually got a very well-documented record. And I have to say that, you know, the Democrats, the so-called resistance party, and we have to put this on the table, too. They've done a few stunts. They've done some things. Cory Booker said, I'm going to do civil disobedience. I don't know if people caught this. He made a big show of this. I'm going to do civil disobedience and read into the record some of Kavanaugh's record that was kept confidential that we're not supposed to release to the public because the public has a right to know. And it is messed up. It's part of the fascism of this Republican Party to have withheld so much. I mean, so much of this guy's public record or his record in public office has been withheld, not public office, in working for the government and the Bush administration and so on. But the real issue is not that not enough is out in the public, because there's plenty in the public for the world to see what his record is. And so this is a way the Democrats, Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, and others have made a show of opposing this supposedly, but really on very narrow terms. And what Kavanaugh's record shows is that he has ruled consistently for interpreting the First Amendment as something that gives the right of religious bigots, Christian fascists, the right to impose their bigotry on others. And if they don't get that right, supposedly, according to Kavanaugh's interpretation, that is a violation of their religious freedom. Explicitly, to give just one example, I mean, the question of abortion is very germane, but also there was a Priest for Life case where, I mean, it was an incredible concession that Obama bent over backwards to give to religious bigots and Christian fascists to begin with when he did the Affordable Care Act and said, okay, it will cover birth control, but if you're a religious institution, or if you're, you know, you, even if you provide secular services, if you don't want to provide birth control, just fill out a form. We'll make an exception for you. So already this is bending over backwards to allow religious bigots to withhold coverage for birth control for women. The right to birth control, central to women's ability to participate freely in society, is the ability to control their reproduction, to have sex and sexuality without having it linearly, always mandatorily tied to giving birth, whether they want to or not. And Obama said, oh, we can accept you from that. You can fill out a form. You don't have to do that. And Priest for Life said, no, that's still a violation of our religious freedom, because if we fill out a form saying we won't provide birth control to women that work for us, then it'll allow the government to provide that coverage for those women. So we're still participating. Unless we can withhold this from the women who work for us and make it unknown to the state so that they can't provide it anyhow. I mean, this is somehow a religious discrimination to prevent a religious bigot from depriving a woman that they employ from birth control. So this is just one of many examples. I didn't mean to take so much time on one example. I won't go through all the examples. But this man, around prayer in school, around giving government funding to religious institutions, around voting rights, around the enormous fight that has been waged to expand access to higher education and other realms of life for Black people, people of color, generally women and other minorities. These are all things that are on the chopping block with this man. In the context of a situation, again, where you have a fascist regime in power that is resurrecting white supremacist marches with torches and out in the streets and calling on police to not be too nice when they arrest people. You know, one of the other things that Kavanaugh has upheld. He really celebrates and says Judge Rehnquist was his first judicial hero. And in that, he cites Rehnquist's dissent from Roe v. Wade, the fact that he disagreed with the legalization of abortion. And he also cites and upholds a lot of Rehnquist's ruling to undermine the protections of those accused of crimes. So, for example, you know, if the police do an illegal search of your body, of your car, of your home, or if they extract information from you before reading your Miranda rights, your right to remain silent, that evidence is supposed to be illegal to use in a court of law. It was illegally obtained. And Rehnquist really undermined that and opened wider and wider loopholes. And this is another thing that Kavanaugh celebrated. So all the police power, at a time when already you've got 2.3 million people in prison, one out of every three Black boys born today will end up in the criminal justice system. Here you have a president and a regime rooted in and celebrating white supremacy and calling for greater police violence and repression. And then you have a Supreme Court judge who is a tipping point judge who is saying, yeah, oh, we're too soft on the criminals and those accused. We need to expand police powers. So these are just a few of the things. And there's presidential powers, the right of the president to be above the law. I mean, it just goes on and on. But this is a very radical, outright fascist remaking at a time when there is a fascist regime and program and power being hammered into place. So it's not an abstract theoretical question for the future. These are, you know, right now there are at least 10 cases going through the federal courts, working their way up to the Supreme Court, that would do frontal violence to the limited access that women have to abortion, either outright overturning Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court level, or even further undermining and gutting what limited access women have in this country already.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism. Now, Sansara, actually, I couldn't agree more with what you're saying. And in my mind, it's like, look, what's happening in relation to this is a very real and a very dangerous tipping point. And I was talking to people yesterday, just like listening to what they're saying and what are they thinking about. And some of the things that kept coming up was, and it made me think about this, the danger. You know, a lot of people were saying, okay, well, yeah, but the Democrats, there's these people that are in there, they're trying to fight their way through, they're trying to expose this. You have Kamala Harris doing, you know, really seriously questioning him, not letting him get away with anything. And, you know, what really struck me is there's a real danger of sort of, one, not recognizing that actually what this is and what's going on, but also there's a danger in depending on the Democrats to actually step up in all this and make a big difference and sort of turn the tables around.
Yeah, I think I want to say concretely a couple of things the Democrats have actually done and what they have not done. And then I want to talk about a little bit about why and what the implications of that are. But I want to say the Democrats know right now that there is enormous fear and anger about what's being done by the Trump-Pence regime in general and what is represented by Kavanaugh in particular. And they know that if they don't act like they're fighting this, they are not going to be able to arouse those they appeal to vote for them in the fall. They're not going to be able to, they're going to lose their legitimacy. And they know that there's an incredible amount of disaffection and anger with them already because of how much they have allowed, how much they have normalized of this fascism. So they know they have to put up the show of fighting this. And so they've done some stunts and they've asked some tough questions and they've done this and they've done that. But I want to just note, number one, they just last week, Chuck Schumer fast-tracked 15 of Trump's federal court nominees. They have allowed, you know, you do a study of contrast. Under Obama, who appointed very far to the right judges to begin with, but under Obama, or many of them, the Republicans blocked his appointees. People know about Merrick Garland, who they blocked, but they blocked a record number of judicial appointees, so many that when Trump came to office, there was there was 106 vacancies on the federal bench. They blocked this so much so that if you were a judge in a lot of places, or you got nominated to be a judge, a lot of people started turning down the nominations because their whole career would be on hold for a year or two while they got held up and held up and held up, and they couldn't go forward, they couldn't go back. And so people were saying, no, I don't want to be even appointed, because they knew it wasn't going to go anywhere. The Republicans blocked this so that they would have a slate of empty benches. Then they get into power with Trump and the Senate, and they are fast-tracking this. And the Democrats have done nothing to slow this down. They have green-lighted a record number of judicial fascist judges on the federal bench, and they voted for and they gave their approval, enough of them, for Gorsuch. And now they're sitting there, and they could walk out. They could shut this down. They could say, no, this can't go forward. There's millions of lives on the line. Instead, they say, you know, they called on the first day Dick Durbin asked Kavanaugh to postpone his hearings until they could review all the documents that hadn't been released. I mean, that is you're going to appeal to this fascist nominee to postpone his own hearings. That's the acme of their wit. Cory Booker says, I'm going to do civil disobedience and read into the record a piece of documentation, which was damning, but is not different than what was known about this man. And so they're putting up a show of making an obstacle, but really what they're doing is they're obfuscating. And they're making the question, we don't know enough, you're not being forthcoming enough, rather than his record is clear and it's hostile to the rights and lives of women, of black people, of immigrants, of civil liberties, of the environment. The guy has 75 times struck down environmental regulations. This guy is a nightmare for the planet. And the Democrats are not stopping them. So concretely, that's not what's going on. And then why? There's a question. Look, fundamentally, they're part of the same system. That's what's playing out. They have differences with Trump. They do not agree with Trump. They don't agree with Kavanaugh. But they're coming at it from the perspective of how to hold together their empire, their interests, as they share the same interests as rulers of a capitalist, imperialist American system. And that's what the Constitution reflects. Bob Avakian makes the point that and Karl Marx made the point in a different way, that every set of laws, every set of rights, every Constitution fundamentally reflects, flows from, and has to serve and reinforce the underlying property relations and mode of production. It's why you can't have the right to eat in a capitalist society, because it runs up against the right of the capitalist to make money off of selling food. You can't have the right to housing because you can't have the right for everybody to engage in science or to encounter each other as non-antagonistic classes, because those things run counter to the mode of production of capitalism. So what you have right now is you have a fight among the rulers, and it's a very sharp fight, but it is a fight around the interests of the rulers, which are antagonistic to the interests of the people. And the people, most of all, more than anything else, we need an actual revolution. We need a system that is not reflected by the Supreme Court as it becomes fascist, or the Supreme Court before this fascist nominee that was the Supreme Court that oversaw Law and Order of 2.3 million people in prison. I mean, this is a Supreme Court that already had dragnet, wiretaps, spying, green-lighted, that had allowed the atrocities that we are seeing being done to immigrants and their children being put in cages. This is not a system where you want to pick between those fighting it out on the top. You need to be getting organized to overthrow this system, to implement a radically different system, and based on meeting people's needs, not on capitalism, and based on overcoming this oppression and rooted in the Constitution, which actually has been written by Bob Avakian for a radically different system, the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America. That's a legal system where people's rights would be fundamentally protected, including the right to come together and transform these conditions of oppression and enslavement and exploitation that we've been forced to endure for so long since the founding of this country in slavery and genocide. And then the second point that I want to draw from this, and this will be my last point, is that as part of making revolution, and what everybody has to confront, whether you're fully convinced of the need for revolution or not right now, is that the Supreme Court is not our court. The Democratic Party, that is not our party. they do not represent our interests. And fight as they might, they are also normalizing and leading you to collaborate and capitulate to what they are accepting as a fait accompli, a fascist Supreme Court and a fascist regime in power. And our interests are opposed to that, and we have to step outside of relying on them, begging them, pressuring them. We have to go into the streets and wage actual struggle, not aimed at pressuring them, but aimed at creating such a massive upheaval from below, such a mass outpouring of determination from below, that they can't go forward with this agenda. That fundamentally and ultimately, and this is what refusefascism.org is organized to do and is fighting for, is to recognize that with fascism, you have to stop it before it becomes too late. You have to drive it out of power. You can't just chase after it piecemeal and object to each thing as it gets locked into place. You have to drive out the regime. And that's what Refuse Fascism is fighting to do, is to bring forward, starting with thousands and soon, before too long, millions who go into the streets and they stay in the streets. And we stay in the streets and we refuse to accept this and we demand the whole Trump-Pence regime must go. People did it in South Korea. They drove out a president 2 years ago. People did it a few months ago in Armenia. People have done this around the world, not by relying on the institutions and mechanisms of the dictatorship, the system that rules over us, but by relying on the people ourselves. And for those of us who see the need for a revolution and other people who need to get into that and learn about that, doing this as we're building up the forces and propagating the need and getting organized to make an actual revolution.
Mm-hmm. All right, Sansara Taylor, you wound up just in time. That was very good, actually, and very deep. And I think people really need to follow that. And give people some suggestions real quick, because you only got about a minute or so, some suggestions of where they could go to learn more. There's RevCom.us. And are there other things or specific articles or anything that you think they should be reading right now? Because it's important that people break out of the confines of everyday life, because the system is breaking out of all this. And we need to be up there with being able to come at it from our own side.
Absolutely. And I thank you for having me on about this. I think the number one thing on this question of Constitution and the laws and the Supreme Court and what's at stake, I would really urge people to go to RevCom.us and look at a piece. It's called The Constitution, Law, and Rights in Capitalist Society and in the Future Socialist Society. And it's selections from writings of Bob Avakian, who's the leader of the revolution and of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And it includes excerpts from the Constitution from the New Socialist Republic in North America that he authored, as well as other things wrestling with the whole role of the rights, the law, Constitution, the U.S. Supreme Court, how the courts would work under socialism, genuine revolutionary socialism. This is a very important piece. It'll lift your sights and it'll help you see beneath the surface of what's going on with this fight today and what is the role of the courts under this system. So that's at RevCom.us, Constitution, Law, and the Rights. And then I would encourage, explore that website. We are covering the Kavanaugh hearings. We're doing exposure on who he is and what else is going on with the Trump-Pence regime and the movement for an actual revolution. So I would urge everybody to go there and browse the site more generally. And then I would call on everybody to go to refusefascism.org, which is a movement which includes communist revolutionaries like myself. It includes people who don't want a revolution but also don't want fascism and are coming from very different perspectives. And we're standing together in this fight, and you'll hear different voices there. And there is a place for everybody in this movement. If you refuse to accept a fascist America in the name of humanity, there's a role for you to play and something important you've got to do. And it is not, this fascism is not going to stop by begging or voting or waiting for the Democrats or Mueller. It's going to take all of us in struggle, and that is refusefascism.org.
All right, Sansara Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Take care, Michael.
You too. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us and Revolution Newspaper. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
Check, check, 1-2-1-2, Alabama, Indiana. They be coming around asking, who the f*** is...
All right, welcome back. That was Hail to the Chief from Prophets of Rage. I want to bring on my next guest, who is Jen Marlowe. She's been involved in writing about the recent arrests and protesting of the Bayou Bridge pipeline for quite some time, and there's been these recent arrests. On September 4th, four people were arrested protesting at the Bayou Bridge pipeline in Louisiana, and the four were arrested and many more violently attacked on private land that they had permission to be on. Police and ETP workers and private security responded with batons, pepper spray, and brute force. The four were held on trumped-up felony charges, and they're now out of jail, and you can find the story by going to my Facebook page. But right now, I want to bring on to the show Jen Marlowe and what she's learned about what's going on down in Louisiana with the new pipeline that they're trying to build. Deep in Louisiana, water protectors take action to keep a pipeline out of Black and Indigenous communities. An encampment of protesters in Louisiana is resisting the crude oil industry, whose environmental disasters disproportionately affect the poor and people of color. Joining us to talk about this is Jen Marlowe. Jen is an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and human rights social justice activist. She's the founder of Donkey Saddle Projects, which creates pieces within the realm of film, theater, and creative nonfiction to amplify stories of resistance and struggles for equality and liberation. And she's written a very important piece on what's going on with the water protectors down in Louisiana and the people determined to destroy the environment. Jen Marlowe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's great to be back on.
Yeah, it's really good to talk to you again. I always think of you when these major things come up, and I think, Jen's got something to say about this. So I'm really glad we're able to talk about this.
Well, I'm delighted that that's the context in which I come to your mind.
There you go. You recently wrote an article on Black and Indigenous communities in Louisiana, taking actions to keep an oil pipeline from being built in their communities. Who and what's happening here?
So this is in southern Louisiana. And the pipeline that is being built there is the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, which is actually the tail end of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, of course, there was so much inspiring protest against at Standing Rock a few years ago. So the Bakken crude oil that is starting in North Dakota and going through the Dakota Access Pipeline is actually supposed to be ending at oil refineries in St. James Parish, which is in southern Louisiana, carried there the last, I believe, 160 or so miles in the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. And so a very vibrant resistance movement has grown in southern Louisiana, led by primarily by Indigenous women and women of color and all people of color. And that resistance movement is trying to prevent the pipeline from being completed, trying to save basically the largest swamp in the U.S. Is what this is going through, the Atchafalaya Basin. And so it's trying to save that basin. So for all those environmental reasons and also for health reasons, the community of St. James, in which the pipeline is slated to end, they're essentially trapped. And with this pipeline, that is one more in a growing number of petrochemical plants and oil refineries and oil storage tanks that is not only causing great pollution for the residents of St. James, but also traps them if there's any kind of industrial-related accident, spill, leak. They have no way out. So one of the central demands of the pipeline resistance movement is to provide an evacuation route for the residents of St. James. And things are really heating up there. I was there a couple of weeks ago, and since the time that I was there, it was actually a month ago that I spent about almost a week there with the activists in southern Louisiana, and things have really ratcheted up, and the stakes are very high. And activists are in kayaks in the bayou trying to prevent construction from happening. Activists are in what's called tree pods over the pipeline easements, again, in the basin, trying to prevent construction. And Louisiana, just on August 1st, passed a law which criminalizes this kind of protest, any protest that is against what it now calls critical infrastructure, which is how the pipeline is described, is considered with this new law, leads now to charges of felonies. So charges that used to be trespassing charges, which would maybe lead to a fine if convicted, are now actually being prosecuted as felonies. And this kind of law was enacted specifically to target this kind of peaceful resistance against the Bayou Bridge pipeline. So the activists there, the stakes have gotten much higher, but they are continuing to do everything in their power and come up with new, creative, nonviolent, direct action ways to try to save their land and their communities.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to go back and revisit some of the things that you just said. Like, for instance, this law that was passed, this HB 727, and it's one of, as you mentioned, numerous anti-protest laws that have happened in the wake of what's been happening in connection to the struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline. And there's been people arrested. Let's talk about what the scene is there, because I've also read where this is not just sort of a kind of like a couple of knuckleheads out there patrolling the swamps. This is actually something that's very well coordinated, including using military forces and police forces to actually do this for the oil companies.
Absolutely. So a few things that I want to respond to in what you just said. So like you said, this new law that was passed in Louisiana does not exist in a vacuum. The Louisiana law is quite similar, startlingly similar to a bill that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has been promoting nationwide. And this directly grew out of the protests at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. So what's happening in Louisiana, there's a lot of parallels to what's happening in other parts of the country and how folks are who are protesting for the rights of people and to protect the environment are going up against very, very well-coordinated business and corporate interests that are being led by groups such as ALEC. That's one response I want to make to what you just said. But also, you were talking about the very well-coordinated, I'm going to use the word, policing efforts to the resistance in the pipeline. It's actually been exposed, you know, relatively recently. Karen Savage, who's an investigative journalist, who's been doing a lot of work covering the Bayou Bridge pipeline and the resistance to it, recently exposed that there's well-documented links between the police and official law enforcement departments and Energy Transfer Partners, which is the lead corporation in partnership along with Phillips 66 that is building the Bayou Bridge pipeline. So off-duty police officers and folks working for the board of, you know, parole officers are getting second jobs, off-duty jobs, working for Energy Transfer Partners, working as private security for Energy Transfer Partners. So that's problematic in a number of ways. One is that if law enforcement officers are supposed to be protecting the rights of people, but they're actually also working for the very company that is building the pipeline, then where are their loyalties going to go? Who are they going to be? Who are they going to be prioritizing in their protection? And you can imagine that it's not going to be the protesters. Their loyalties are going to go towards the companies who are paying them in their off-duty jobs. So the conflict of interest inherent in that is extremely problematic. Another thing that's problematic is that there's been documentation that they are using resources, taxpayer resources, in their off-duty jobs for these private corporations. So they are wearing, first of all, often wearing insignia, hats or shirts that are identifying them as police or public officials when they're actually at that moment working at their second job for a private company. And they're also using vehicles, police vehicles, and other infrastructure that is from law enforcement, from, you know, taxpayers' money that's supposed to be for public good, but they're using this in service in their second jobs working as security for Energy Transfer Partners. And so this is part of what Savage exposed in a recent article that she came out with that's really looking at this cozy relationship between ETP, Energy Transfer Partners, and law enforcement, which, of course, is supposed to be a public service for public good.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's also been reports of things like the KKK and others like that, including something called the American Legislative Exchange Council being involved in all this as well, right?
Well, the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, that's what I was explaining earlier. They have been promoting a nationwide bill that is very similar to the bill that Louisiana just passed, criminalizing this kind of protest, making trespassing on pipeline easements, pipeline property, a felony. So that's been ALEC's role. The name of the No Bayou Bridge Resistance Camp, the name that they chose for themselves is Lo Elavi. What I understand is that was chosen by some of the indigenous activists who started the camp. Lo Elavi means water is life. And so the name of the camp is really holding up the importance of our earth, our water, our natural resources, how that if we're serious about protecting human life, we have to protect our earth and our water. And that's at the core of what they're doing in the swamps and in the bayous. In terms of the white supremacist groups, absolutely. There's absolutely been a component in what's going on and in the harassment that the water protectors are facing in southern Louisiana, it's absolutely brought out white supremacists. There are groups several times, multiple times a week, it was told to me when I was reporting from Louisiana, cars drive by the low LV, the resistance camp, and shout out white power as they're driving past. And there's been other really disturbing examples of how folks have tried to threaten or intimidate water protectors. Sometimes it's not clear whether it's law enforcement. Sometimes it's not clear whether it's off-duty law enforcement or private citizens. But there absolutely have been white supremacist leanings that have been expressed by folks who have been involved in this kind of harassment. And there's been physical assaults and physical attacks that water protectors have endured. And sometimes it's absolutely known and clear that those attacks were perpetrated by folks connected to energy transfer partners or connected to the pipeline. And sometimes there hasn't been clear evidence of that, but the assumption of the water protectors who have been attacked because of these patterns that have taken place now over a number of months, it feels very clear to them that these were, you know, off-duty law enforcement or other folks who are supporting and in connection to energy transfer partners have perpetrated physical assaults on water protectors.
Boy, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Jen Marlowe. Jen is an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and human rights social justice activist. She's the founder of Donkey Saddle Projects, which creates pieces within the realm of film, theater, and creative nonfiction to amplify stories of resistance and struggles for equality and liberation. You know, and one of the things I kept thinking about as I was just reading up on this stuff and just trying to follow it and figure out, you know, it's very heavy because when you look at this, when you look at the connection between what was happening, you know, a year or so ago in the Dakotas and the whole Dakota pipeline, and then this being the bottom end of that and what this is all yep. aimed at doing. It's something I think a lot of people don't recognize because it's always presented as something as sort of like, well, it's down here in Louisiana, this is happening, and then up here in the north, this is happening. But it's actually part of this very dangerous and, you know, the system that's being erected and put into place.
Absolutely. And yeah, I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people don't realize when they're looking at what's happening at Dakota Access, well, where is the Bakken crude oil that's flowing through that pipeline ending? It's ending in southern Louisiana. So the Bayou Bridge pipeline is the tail end of the Dakota Access pipeline. And if you're looking at the most impacted communities on both ends of the pipeline, there's one activist that I had the honor of spending time with in southern Louisiana. Her name is Ann Whitehat. And she is an indigenous woman originally from Rosebud, South Dakota, and relocated to New Orleans about 8 years ago. So her home of origin and her adopted home are close to both ends of this pipeline. And what she has seen at both ends of the pipeline is that it's communities of color who are being most impacted. And that for her has been one of the reasons why she's dedicated herself to this resistance, because she's seeing whose lives are being impacted most, whose lives, as in so many other environmental justice issues and social justice and racial justice issues, whose lives are treated as dispensable. And, it, you know, it was the folks at Standing Rock in the case of the Dakota Access struggle, and now it's the folks in St. James, which is a primarily Black community in southern Louisiana. And those are the lives, the people whose water, the people whose air are being most threatened by both ends of the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. Now, one question before we move on to another subject here, but this Energy Transfer Partners and its co-partner, Phillips 66, they actually have a pretty nefarious history of oil spill problems, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't have at my fingertips all the facts and figures, unfortunately, to be able to offer to you. But what I can say is, and this is, anyone with Google can dig in and find the specifics of it, but there is a vast history of spills and accidents and problems that they have been responsible for. So one could argue that any company building a pipeline, that's problematic. The pipelines are problematic just inherently, and I think there's truth to that. But it's also true that this particular company, Energy Transfer Partners, is a particularly egregious company when you look at their history of accidents and spills.
Mm-hmm. Let's jump into this part about the resistance that people were mounting. It was very moving to actually read about some of the things that people were doing around this. And I wanted to go through a couple of them with you. Like, one of the things that really struck me is this floating resistance camp that developed, which I thought was really ingenious, and given where all this is happening and what it's actually doing in the face of this push by these fascistic oil companies to move ahead.
Yeah, it's really quite extraordinary. The creativity of the resistance that's happening at the No Bayou Bridge pipeline camp is really quite amazing. A large segment of the pipeline is being built, like, literally in the swamp, in the bayou, in the Atchafalaya Basin, and it's only actually accessible by water. And so activists have created a resistance site in the bayou, in the swamp. And so there's kayak activists, water protectors in kayaks that are trying to block pipeline construction literally from the water. And then there's encampments, you know, in the swamp. Often, by the way, on privately owned land. One of the things also that's recently been exposed is that ETP has not gotten the permission from some of the landowners who own land in the basin to construct the pipeline through those lands. And the activists have gotten permission from those landowners to have their encampments there. ETP, regardless, has proceeded to build the pipeline, even on land that they have not received permission to build through in the swamp, in the basin. And the activists who have received written permission in some instances from those landowners have still been targeted and arrested and are being charged with felonies. And so that is one thing that has been exposed pretty recently. But activists are staging their resistance literally from water, from the swamps, and finding all kinds of creative ways to, especially now that there's this law that criminalizes to the extent of a felony anyone who has actually set foot on the pipeline easement. So they've very creatively built these tree pods over the pipeline easement, which is, you know, it's like a platform over the easement that is then attached to trees on. And so they're literally like in a pod above the easement, and in that way trying to block progress on construction. And they've been quite successful in doing that. Actually, another really inspiring detail is that the sort of base camp for Loe Levy, which is in Rain, Louisiana, it's online, that one of the water protectors, Sherry Fortland, she had purchased this land when she learned that this land was actually in the route of the pipeline. She purchased the land with the intent of turning it into this resistance camp, and the actual purchase of that land forced ETP to reroute the pipeline because she obviously wasn't going to give permission for that land to have the pipeline through it. And so that was one example where they did end up rerouting around what became Loe Levy resistance camp.
Mm-hmm. What about talking about some of the, what are the actual demands of the water protectors?
Of course, one of the central demands is to stop the construction of the pipeline itself. But another very central demand of their struggle is to provide an evacuation route for the community in St. James Parish, southern Louisiana, where the pipeline is slated to end. In the 5th district of St. James, which I mentioned, this district is primarily Black and primarily low-income community. And on this particular stretch, the stretch is called, it's like a petrochemical corridor, which is colloquially known as Cancer Alley, because of the extent of the health-related problems that have arisen from the pollution of the multiple petrochemical plants, oil refineries, gas tanks that have sprouted along this route. These folks have no way out of the community were there to be a spill or an accident of some sort by any of the plants or by the pipeline that is now being built. There's one road, which would be a 3-hour traffic jam of folks trying to get out. And on one side, they're hemmed in by the Mississippi River. And on the other side, they're hemmed in basically by sugarcane fields. There's no access for them to get out. There's no evacuation route. So one of the central demands of the resistance movement is to provide an evacuation route for the folks in St. James. And that's actually something that Energy Transfer Partners is supposed to do. Like, they are supposed to be providing that, and they have not yet done so. And there was actually a court ruling that came down, which is now being appealed, but it's a court ruling that came down recently, which is basically saying that that they have not, that's affirming what the activists, what the water protectors have been saying, which is that Energy Transfer Partners has not taken care of the need to ensure community safety by providing an evacuation route for this community in St. James. And the court ruling was that it was that the Department of Natural Resources had to ensure that Energy Transfer Partners would provide this evacuation route. But the Department of Natural Resources, which is, has this cozy relationship with ETP, is actually appealing now this decision. At least that was the latest update I heard. I don't know if anything has developed in the last week or two on the legal front. So how that will play out right now is unknown. But it is very significant that a judge's ruling affirmed that ETP was required and has not yet fulfilled their requirement to provide this evacuation route, and they should not be continuing any construction on the pipeline until the safety of the people and the lives of the people in St. James has been properly protected.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Jen Marlowe. Jen is an author, documentary filmmaker, playwright, and human rights social justice activist. She's the founder of Donkey Saddle Projects, which creates pieces within the realm of film, theater, and creative nonfiction to amplify stories of resistance and struggles for equality and liberation. Let me ask you this. There's a man named Travis London who actually seemed to be pretty involved in this and played a pretty important role in how it's developed, in addition to other people. He began to investigate plans to build the Bayou Bridge pipeline and learned that there were a whole lot of petrochemical plants in the area, things that he said he actually hadn't known until he began this investigation.
First of all, Travis London is a phenomenal young man, father of four, involved in every single activist issue imaginable under the sun, and really understands that all these issues are connected to each other and understands that the environmental issues at the heart of the No Bayou Bridge pipeline undergirds all of those struggles. So he's struggling to try to improve education in this community, to try to improve access to health care against gun violence and for gun control, and he really sees all of these struggles as interconnected. Travis lives in Donaldsonville, which is the neighboring community to St. James, although his grandfather's from St. James, so he has a deep connection to the St. James community. Travis had done a lot of environmental activism, and then the mentor that he was working for passed away, and he took a five-year hiatus. For 5 years, he wasn't as involved anymore with environmental activism. And then he started hearing just in the community people talking about problems, that there was this pipeline being built, this Bayou Bridge pipeline, and that there were problems with it, and that the community in St. James were really unhappy because of how it was going to be adding to the already pretty toxic level of pollution in their air, and about the evacuation route. And he's like, well, I need to check this out for myself. So it had been a while since he had driven from his home in Donaldsonville to the neighboring parish of St. James. And as he was driving, he was amazed at just in these couple of years how many new petrochemical plants had sprouted up. He hadn't realized the extent to which industry had expanded just in these few years since he had taken a pause from his activism. And that's what convinced him that he needed to just dive right back into this cause. And so he went to a community hearing. That's where he met the folks from the No Bayou Bridge Pipeline movement, including Cherie Foytlin, and really began to get just fully jumped right back in with both feet and has been extremely involved. He does research around Energy Transfer Partners and other pipeline-related research. He joined the HELP Association in St. James, which is a community group, an environmental activist community group, because, of course, the environmental causes are absolutely connected to health issues and issues of well-being for the community in St. James. Environmental justice is always interlinked with social justice, racial justice, health issues. We can't separate those. And so Travis has gotten very involved in that struggle and is really one of the folks at the forefront in the area around, you know, of St. James and around St. James, of trying to stop the pipeline and trying to expose what the pipeline is doing and trying to make sure that his community, the community in St. James, will have a way out if an accident does occur so that they won't be which is what the situation is now. And there have been accidents in the past in St. James. There have been leaks. There have been spills. We always are reassured by industry that these pipelines are so safe and that accidents aren't going to happen, and they always do. And when the next one happens in St. James, folks there will pay a really dear price with their lives unless an evacuation route for them, a proper evacuation route, is created.
Let's pursue this a little bit more, because one of the things that struck me as I was doing the research on this, it's very heavy when we talked about a little while ago about the link between what was going on in the Dakota Access Pipeline and then what's happening down here in Louisiana. And that link is very real and physical and actual and exists. And at the same time, there's also this question of the importance the importance of this area to people's lives. I mean, it's a lot of times people just don't realize that there's actually whole communities and whole cultures that have grown up around this. And there's a real importance of this area to a whole community of people in that area. Let's talk about that a little.
The area around the bayous, around the Atchafalaya Basin, the area has been a home to many, many different indigenous communities who have relied on the basin and relied on those waterways for so many aspects of their ways of life. You know, economic reliance, reliance for travel and transportation. The area in southern Louisiana have had different layers of colonization. And so being able to be deep in the bayous and deep in the swamps was one of the ways that indigenous folks had of being able to maintain their communities safe from different colonizers who came in. I actually had a really fascinating, wonderful conversation with a woman named Monique Verdin, who both sits on the council for Loe Levi Camp and is also on the tribal council for the Houma Nation. She was talking to me a little bit about the history of the area and the different nations and the different languages and the different communities who have depended for their livelihood and their way of life on the Atchafalaya Basin, which is now being directly threatened by the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. So there's a really rich, deep history in the swamps of Louisiana. There's rich ecological and environmental history. There's cypress trees, bird life, fish life, crawfisher folk. You know, their way of life requires a clean basin. The life of the different indigenous communities who have historically made their settlements along the different bayous there, Bayou Lafourche being one of them. All of that is fundamentally threatened by the building of this pipeline.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I wanted to talk about, too, is that when you think about all this, you know, and you had just referred to this, but the promise of progress and the reality of what comes with this kind of capitalist profit-driven development is something that really is just weighing very, very heavily on the people there, I would think, even if they're not aware of it. But the idea that there's this kind of this reality that capitalism goes for certain things and it's to hell with the people and their needs and what their communities are like. It's actually going out there to just reap profit, and to do so, if they have to destroy the environment, it doesn't matter. And that seems to be a big part of what's going on here.
Absolutely. And you know, in southern Louisiana, industry is king, so to speak. And by industry, of course, it means like the oil and gas industry. And industry holds out these promises that they represent jobs, that they represent security, and they hold out this idea that they are the only source of jobs and that they are the only source of security. And both Travis London and Monique Verdin were really resisting that idea and understood that in order to get really, really, there is a lot of community support for the No Bayou Bridge Pipeline resistance effort, but in order to really expand that support, one of the areas of work they have to do is make sure that those alternatives are actually being developed so that folks don't have to rely on the industry for their only chance at having a job, and that folks don't have to rely on the capitalist notion that, like, you have to sacrifice tomorrow's well-being in order to feed your family today, because that's what it comes down to. Folks need to be able to put food in front of their hungry children that night. And so they're not then offered the privilege of thinking about what their family's health and well-being is going to be tomorrow. They're too busy trying to, you know, having to focus on feeding their family tonight. And industry purposely keeps people, capitalism purposely keeps people in that cycle. You know, Monique made a really poignant and powerful point in our conversation where she talked about that the infrastructure that started, the plantation infrastructure that started with slavery is the same infrastructure that's getting exploited and used by capitalism and by these pipelines that are, you know, because southern Louisiana is so heavily piped. This is not obviously the only pipeline in southern Louisiana. And so that, you know, the descendants of folks who were slaves and then sharecroppers are now the folks who are working minimum wage jobs in these plants and don't feel like they have any other alternatives in order to feed their families. So it's the same systems of exploitation starting from slavery and continuing with the pipeline. And that's one of the things that the resistance camp, that the Loe Elevi camp, was very intentional about. I had a great conversation with an activist, Felicia Teeter, who had actually been arrested the day after I got to the camp. I went to cover an action they were doing in which outside a radio show that the governor was doing, the governor of Louisiana, and they were trying to call on the governor to provide an evacuation route for St. James. Felicia was one of three water protectors arrested in that action. And when we were reflecting afterwards on what she was doing, both at that action but also at the camp, she was talking really about the vision that the camp was trying to build of yes, they are there in order to resist the pipeline. As Felicia said it to me, she considers herself a radical activist, and she says the definition of being radical means going to the root of things. And one of the roots of what's causing misery and suffering right now, one of those roots is going underneath the bayou in southern Louisiana, is the Bayou Bridge Pipeline. And so that was why she was there. And she sees her resistance as being there, as being a part of protecting. She's both Black and Indigenous. She's part of the Yakama Nation in the Pacific Northwest. And she sees what she's doing in southern Louisiana as directly being about protecting Black lives and Indigenous lives. And she sees what is happening at the camp in terms of trying to create another way of being in the world and trying to create another kind of model of how to be in community with one another. And it's very intentional how folks are creating community at the camp itself, that's part of creating the vision of alternatives of what could be possible. It might not right this moment provide the answer to Monique's question of what kind of jobs, what kind of ways will people be able to feed their families if they're not working for industry. I think there's still a lot of work to do to build these communities in such a way that it can actually meet all of the different needs of society. But that's a big intention of what this camp is doing. It's trying to imagine and envision and put into place a different way that we can build community, a different way that we can be with each other and in the world that won't rely on pipelines, that won't rely on extractive capitalism, that won't rely on capitalism at all. And that's one of the really beautiful things that's happening out in the swamps in southern Louisiana right now.
Mm-hmm. And one last comment, which is that everything you've been saying just really does sharpen up the point that resistance. We do not have to accept what this system throws at us, and that the people standing up and resisting this is incredibly important today.
That was one of the exact points that Monique Verdon made in our conversation. She spoke about just one of the successes she sees of the No Bayou Bridge encampment is its existence and in the model that it shows the community. This community has been so beaten down, she told me, and that they've been told over and over, you have oil or gas or you have nothing. And this movement that's happening with the pipeline, this resistance, is showing to folks, no, you don't have to accept that. You don't have to accept a pipeline going through your backyard. As Felicia Teeter told me, you don't have to accept, by the same token as not having to accept a pipeline, you don't have to accept, you know, police killing Black and brown youth, that it is all interconnected, that people can stand up and say no, and that they can create another kind of reality for each other. That the importance of that resistance, that the fact of that resistance in and of itself is tremendously important and a tremendous source of inspiration, I think, for a lot of folks who have had the chance to see what's happening at the resistance camp and a lot of folks who are impacted by the Bayou Bridge pipeline. One other thing I'd like to just say about the importance of resistance is that the Lo Elavi camp is calling on folks to come and join them. And so if you just Google No Bayou Bridge Pipeline, you'll be able to find their information, find their website. But they're actively asking for folks to come and join them, be in the bayou. They need people, they need bodies if they're going to stop this pipeline from being built. Energy Transfer Partners is saying that they will have the pipeline finished before the end of 2018, and they need as much support as they can get at the camp if they're going to prevent that.
All right, Jen Marlo, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Same here. All right, that was Jen Marlo, and I wanted to, we're in a big rush, so I just want to real quick thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer today, Gary Baca. See, I got you on that one, man. And I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we are going to go out now with Sound the Alarm from Thievery Corporation, all right? A very fitting song for a hell of a time.